This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. It Happened One Night was the first movie to sweep the five top Academy Awards in 1934. It remains much loved today. In fact, we love the romantic comedy. It's been with us since the early days of Hollywood. Journalist Daniel Kimmel notes that over time, only the gangster movie seems to have done as well as the romantic comedy. Today, we'll take a look at the best of the genre with the help of Daniel Kimmel. He is the author of the new book, I'll Have What She's Having, Behind the Scenes of the Great Romantic Comedies. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls. You can join us with your questions and comments, your thoughts and memories of the best romantic comedies. Here are the telephone numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. And our toll-free number, it is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Daniel Kimmel is the Boston correspondent for Variety and film reviewer for the Worcester Telegram and Gazette. He's also a contributor to the Boston Globe, Film Comment, and the Christian Science Monitor. I'll Have What She's Having is his third book. He's also the author of The Dream Team and The Fourth Network, How Fox Broke the Rules and Reinvented Television. His new book, I'll Have What She's Having, Behind the Scenes of the Great Romantic Comedies, is published by Ivan R. D. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Daniel Kimmel, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Well, can we start with the film that gave you your title?
Of course, When Harry Met Sally.
Yeah.
I'll Have What She's Having. I've actually eaten at Katz's Deli, where that scene takes place. And if you go there, as I mentioned in the book, you can sit. I was sitting at the next table, but you can sit at that table because there's a sign hanging over it that says, this is where Harry met Sally.
Yeah. Well, tell us the story of Rob Reiner and his mom and how that line came to be in the movie.
I'll give you the whole Megillah, so to speak. Rob Reiner and Nora Ephron and Andrew Scheinman, who was the producer on the film, were talking for several years about doing a film about how men and women relate with each other. And basically, Rob Reiner was divorced, and I think Scheinman was single, and they were telling her all these stories about being single men in L.A., and she was she had been through a couple of marriages herself, and she was based in New York. And finally, Reiner says, you know, we're giving you all this stuff about men. We need to hear what women think, because I want this film to be even-handed. And she goes, well, you know, something that I find, you know, a lot of trouble is the way you guys talk about sex. I was like, you know, you can't wait to get out the door afterwards. That's kind of piggish. And Reiner looks at her and says, well, what do you mean? It's like, you know, she had a good time, too. And Nora Ephron looks at him and goes, well, how do you know that? and she, how do you know the woman's not faking? Well, Reiner had never heard of this before and didn't believe it. And Nora Ephron said, go back to your office. Ask the women in your office if they've ever pretended. And many of them said, yes, well, at least once at some point. And he comes back to her and says, this is great. This has got to be in the movie. And that's where the idea came that got written into this scene. Well, now that they've cast the film, and Billy Crystal, Meg Ryan, and the rest of the cast are sitting around a table doing the first read through the script, just where they all get together and go through it once. And they get to that scene, and Meg Ryan says, you know what would be really funny? If I acted it out to show how I could pretend. And Billy Crystal comes up with the line, yes, and then you have somebody at the next table go, I'll have what she's having. So that's how they get to the line. Now, when they do the scene, Reiner decides to give it to his mother, Estelle Reiner, who just passed away last fall.
Yeah.
And she did not, you know, her husband was Carl Reiner, a big producer, writer, actor, comedian. She had very limited performing experience. She had done a little bit, but she was not a really a professional actress. So she comes to the Katz's Deli to do the scene, and Reiner says to her, "Now, Mom, if you don't get a laugh, I'm going to have to cut you out of the movie." And she says, "It's okay, dear. I just wanted to watch my son work."
Mm.
And, of course, she gets such a huge laugh that they end up having to pad out the scene because people were not able to hear the dialogue in the next scene. They were still laughing from her. It's considered, you know, one of the top 100 funniest lines in movie history, and whoever does that kind of survey. And I think I'll give Reiner the punchline where he goes, "My mother could never say I didn't give her anything."
Mm. Yeah, you know, in the New York Times, the obituary for Estelle Reiner included the line, and the American Film Institute made the line number 33 on its list of the top 100 quotations from movies, just ahead of Lauren Bacall's invitation to Humphrey Bogart. You know how to whistle, don't you, Stevie?
Yeah, it's become, you know, just one of those classic lines. In fact, my working title for the book had been something else, and it was my publisher who suggested that we change it to this, and everybody, including my mother, said, "Oh, that title's much better." It's, you know, it's something that everybody instantly recognizes.
Yeah. You mentioned that at test screenings, the line got such a huge laugh that they padded out the beginning of the next scene. That also happened in Woody Allen's Annie Hall.
Yes, this happens sometimes because, you know, when you're doing a movie, you don't always know what the audience will respond to. And that's why they like to do test screenings. I mean, sometimes they overdo it. They'll, "Oh, let's change the ending. Let's do this." But sometimes it's a matter of figuring out the timing of the material. And in Annie Hall, there is it's a silly joke. It's an old slapstick thing where, in this case, they updated it to the 70s. Alvy and Annie, Woody Allen and Diane Keaton, are visiting with some friends who are introducing them to the then trendy drug cocaine. And Woody Allen has no interest at all in drugs, but he's looking at this white powder. He goes, "Oh, so this is rather expensive." He goes, "Oh yeah, that's, you know, several hundred dollars or whatever it is an ounce." And he goes, "Oh really?" And then all of a sudden he sneezes and the powder goes flying.
Mm-hmm.
That got such a big laugh that now the next scene, it was a driving scene in Los Angeles. They had to add footage and music because people were laughing so much they weren't able to hear what the characters were saying.
That must make a filmmaker really happy to say, "We've got to put in more music here and a little scenery."
We have a problem. People are laughing too much in our comedy. I think most people would love to have that problem.
Yeah. Well, When Harry Met Sally is called the greatest movie Woody Allen never made. Why?
Because when it first came out, I think it was Premiere Magazine ran an article where they showed all the similarities between When Harry Met Sally and both Annie Hall and Manhattan, which were two of Woody Allen's most prominent romantic comedies. And there were all sorts of things, from the use of the song "It Had to Be You" to having the male protagonist run through the streets of New York to reach his beloved at the end of the picture, and all sorts of things. And what I note in the book is that it's not really that Nora Ephron and Rob Reiner were stealing from Woody Allen. It's that they were all drawing from the same sources, humor that comes from this New York Jewish sensibility. And it would be like saying, well, you know, there are certain similarities between Renoir and Monet. Yes, they're both French impressionists, and they knew each other, but that didn't mean one was stealing from the other.
The movie that you write about in I'll Have What She's Having for Woody Allen is Annie Hall. And it began, the title that Woody Allen began with was Anhedonia.
Yeah, this is Annie Hall, which happens to be my personal favorite film. I've seen it many, many, many times. It's a film that's almost an accident. It's not the film that he set out to make. His original conception for the film that he wrote with Marshall Brickman was Anhedonia, which is a psychiatric term for people who are unable to experience pleasure. And it was about his character, Alvy, turning 40 and reflecting back on all of the problems in his life, and of which romance was only one of them. And they finish shooting the film, and they do the rough edit, and he's got a 2.5-hour movie that is all over the place. There's very funny stuff in there, but, you know, like for example, people remember the scene where he goes... describes what his elementary school was like, and the little kids get up, and one of them says, you know, I used to be a heroin addict, and now I'm a methadone addict. And it's a funny little bit. Well, in the original version, that went on for several minutes as we follow some of those characters through their present-day adult life. Well, it was there was no focus to it. So he brought in Ralph Rosenblum, who was a veteran film editor who had helped teach him a bit about filmmaking when he edited Bananas, which was his second film. Take the Money and Run, which was his first film, and showed him how to pace comedy, how to use music, how to focus the film. And in the editing process, they realized that where the film really took off was in the present with Annie. And they started cutting the film to the present relationship. And so a lot of other stuff, a lot of really funny stuff, ended up on the cutting room floor because they decided we're going to tell the story of this relationship. And one of the things they cut and they ended up putting back in was the bit with Christopher Walken as her brother.
Mm.
It's just a funny little scene where he talks about the dream about, you know, having these suicidal fantasies about driving his car into Russian traffic.
Yeah.
And they decided, hey, you know, the film's working. Let's put some stuff back in. And the Christopher Walken's scene got saved. When they finished it and the film was now working a lot better, Alan still wanted to call it Anhedonia. That was his title. And United Artists, which was releasing the film, said, no, let's test different titles on the audience. And so they did test screenings with different titles. One of them was Alvy and Annie. One of them was Anhedonia. And one of them was Annie Hall, which is the one they ended up selecting. One of the United Artists executives, you know, finally put his foot down with Woody Allen. He said, look, we give you a free rein to make whatever movie you want, but we've got to sell this movie. For you and I, this will always be Anhedonia, but for the rest of the public, it's got to be Annie Hall.
Yeah. Well, now I'm going to think of it as Anhedonia. Is there a particular moment in this personal favorite of yours that you're particularly enamored of?
Oh, there's so many great moments.
Yeah.
One of them, I mean, you know, if you ask me tomorrow, I might pick something else. But one of the moments that I love is when he's out on his first date with her, and they're walking to dinner, and all of a sudden he stops. He goes, kiss me. And she goes, really? You know, like right here? He goes, yeah, because otherwise, afterwards, we're going to be self-conscious. We never kissed, and is it too soon or whatever? So let's kiss. We'll get that out of the way, and we'll digest our food better. And I thought, that, you know, what a clever way to get around that first date anxiety. I thought that was really adorable.
Yeah, yeah. And the bit with Annie's brother and the drive to the airport.
The drive to the airport. Some of his playing with movie conventions, I think one of the things that is often remarked on is the scene where he goes back to her apartment after the tennis match, and they're just getting to know each other, and all of a sudden subtitles come on that explain what they're really thinking, and they're just like jabbering in this small talk. And it was very funny to see subtitles used in that fashion.
Yeah, and that is so, we can so relate to that.
Yeah, well. I find that Annie Hall is a film that I've used in my college film comedy classes where I teach the genre, and people do relate to it. What I sometimes have a problem with college students is they don't get the references.
Mm.
I remember showing it one time, and there's a scene where the two of them are sitting in Central Park, and they're making fun of the passersby. It's one of the games they play together, and all of a sudden he points to this guy, goes, "Oh look, it's the winner of the Truman Capote look-alike contest," and it's Truman Capote walking by.
Yeah.
Well, nobody in the class laughed, and I asked them afterwards, and somebody said, who's Truman Capote? I think since the Philip Seymour Hoffman film, they got a sense again.
Yeah. When was it that you fell in love with movies and made it your life, your life's work, and came by these stories?
Oh, well, how I came by the stories is a separate story. But, you know, I've been loving movies since I was a kid. And one day I was going through some of my parents' paper, and I found the birth announcement they sent out when I was born. And I swear this is true. It was a movie marquee with my mother listed as the producer and my father as the director. So I think I was marked from birth.
Oh.
But how I came by these stories about, it's about 10, 12 years ago, I was invited to speak at an assisted living senior housing project. They show a lot of movies to, you know, to the retirees, and some of them are shut-ins, and they were finding that they didn't like a lot of the new movies, and it would I be willing to host an old movies or classic movie series? I said, well, I don't have the time to sit there and watch a lot of movies because I've got to go see the new ones I'm reviewing. But if you would like, I can select the films, and then I can come in after they see them and do a discussion on it. Well, this has become a sideline of mine. I now speak several times a month at more than a half a dozen facilities. I have like a catalog of 60 or 70 lectures where I'm talking about classic films. Well, to be able to do a lecture on a classic film, I've got to research the stories, and what I found was that these stories, marvelous stories, are scattered all over the place. There's only a handful of films that are so beloved, say like a Casablanca or Wizard of Oz or Gone with the Wind, that generates a book or books on the making of the film itself. So, for example, in my book, the chapter on Sabrina, I went to a dozen different sources, books on Audrey Hepburn, William Holden, Humphrey Bogart, Billy Wilder, Edith Head, the fashion designer Hubert de Givenchy, and every one of these places I found some story that hadn't appeared in the others. And I found even my colleagues, the other film critics in the Boston area here, didn't know some of these stories. So I said, you know, I wonder if there's a larger audience for this. And my publisher gave me the go-ahead to put this book together.
Yeah, well, it's a lot of fun. I'm glad this all happened. I'll have what she's having. Behind the Scenes of the Great Romantic Comedies is Daniel Kimmel's latest book. He is our guest this afternoon here in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, if you'd like to join us, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Yes.
Yes.
Woody Allen began having sexual relations with his underage daughter while married to Mia Farrow. He should have been prosecuted for statutory rape and for incest. Quite frankly, he's a criminal. He is not funny. He is a sick and demented man. And I think that needs to be considered in any evaluation of his films. Thank you.
All right. Just not to get, we don't get into a whole discussion on that. I'm not going to defend Woody Allen. I just want to set the record straight. If she was underage when they met, I don't believe there were any sexual relations until she was legal. She was not his daughter. They're married. Obviously, she wasn't his daughter. She was Mia Farrow, his then girlfriend's adopted daughter. I understand, and I don't try to, you know, tell people they're wrong if they're queasy about the whole thing, but I think the caller exaggerated a bit of what the actual facts were.
Okay. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our topic today, romantic comedies. Our guest, Daniel Kimmel, author most recently of I'll Have What She's Having. My name is Celeste Quinn. So why has the romantic comedy endured? Why is it so enduring?
I think it's because all of us have fallen in love, hope to fall in love, are in love. It's an experience we can all relate to. And often, we see it and we're reminded of our own relationships. These movies tell us something about, help us inform our attitudes towards romance. And often other things as well. The Annie Hall look was a fashion statement in the 70s. Sabrina, for that matter, created a fashion statement in the early 1950s. Where Audrey Hepburn became almost a standard of glamour.
Yeah. Is the genre especially good for women?
The genre as a whole, yes. We could argue about individual films. One of the things that surprises people, especially watching the older films, let's say like some of the 1930s screwball comedy, say It Happened One Night or My Name Godfrey, that the women are just as strong-willed and feisty as the men. It's not, little darling, I'll have to take you under my wing and protect you. It becomes a courtship between two equals. If you look at some of the comedies with Carol Lombard, Katharine Hepburn, Jean Arthur, Barbara Stanwyck, these are strong, independent women. And, I, as a father of a daughter, I have no trouble with my daughter looking at films like this in terms of, is she going to, take in these sexist attitudes from old movies? Are there sexist attitudes in old movies? Of course there are, but I tend to find not in the romantic comedies.
Yeah, and of that period that you were just talking about, a lot of really strong dialogue for women.
Yes. Oh, the dialogue in 30s comedy. I could have done the whole book just on 30s comedies. The problem is there are a number of books, not of the nature that I did of telling the story of the making of the films, but there, in terms of books on romantic comedies, there are several excellent books that are, weren't those comedies of the 30s great? Well, having done so many of those, I said, let's do something different. So I picked two or three films, a couple of them not as well known as, say, It Happened One Night, which, of course, everybody writes about. And then I said, let's move on, and we can see how the genre has changed over time. But in the 30s, there's no question, when the talkies came in the late 20s, a lot of playwrights, journalists, authors went out to Hollywood to pick up money because suddenly there was a crying need for people who knew how to write dialogue as opposed to title cards.
Hmm. You begin with a 1932 movie, Trouble in Paradise, one of the films of Ernst Lubitsch, and you say many consider it to be one of the most perfect romantic comedies ever produced. Why? What makes it so good?
Well, Ernst Lubitsch, alas, except for the film buffs and the historians, is largely forgotten today.
Mm-hmm.
Although people, especially if they're watching, say, a Turner Classic Movies, they like old movies, maybe watching his movies like Shop Around the Corner and Ninotchka, and not even realizing that they're enjoying a good Lubitsch film. He was known for his sophistication, his exquisite taste, and his ability to get in more innuendo without offending anyone, and sometimes without the blue noses even realizing they've been had. One of the scenes I mentioned, now Trouble in Paradise comes out in 1932, which is before the production code kicks in 1934. When we think of old movies, we think, even married couples can't be in bed together because, they're so prudish back then. But if you go pre-1934, it's very surprising what they're getting away with, not compared to today, but certainly compared to the movies of the later 30s. He's got a shot in Trouble in Paradise where he's trying to show that Kay Francis and Herbert Marshall are having this passionate love affair. Well, he can't show them in bed together, but he does show them in her bedroom embracing and their shadows falling across the bed. And it's very subtle, but it's like it's not so subtle that if you're looking for it, you go, oh, I know what he's saying.
Yeah.
It's just really like I said, very, very sophisticated, and also some very clever stuff in terms of a romantic triangle with Herbert Marshall, Miriam Hopkins, and Kay Francis, where if you haven't seen the film before, you may not be sure how that relationship ends up working out. Usually you can tell who's supposed to get together with who by the end of the film.
Uh-huh.
And Trouble in Paradise, you're really torn between these two very different but very, very intelligent and strong women, either of whom would be a good match for him.
I'm looking forward to seeing this movie. I've never seen it.
If you don't know who the main players are, you may recognize some of the character players in it, like Edward Everett Horton.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie Ruggles.
Ruggles, yeah.
You may recognize from other films, because they were in films all through the 30s and 40s, and in Edward Everett Horton's case, up until his last film was 1971.
Well, I remember him from my childhood as part of the Fractured Fairy Tales.
Fractured, for sure. He was the narrator.
Yep.
He was one of the voices for the Jay Ward cartoons.
Yep, Rocky and Bullwinkle. Daniel Kimmel, our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine, author of I'll Have What She's Having. We're talking this afternoon about romantic comedies. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that you say really early in the book is very interesting. After World War II, the romantic comedy did what formula situations can often do when they're done well, use formula situations and stock characters to explore new and serious issues in code.
Right. Well, that's one of the reasons I like teaching genre. I teach gangster films and science fiction films and westerns, because you can do things in a genre where people go, westerns, cowboys and Indians, I know all about that, and I could just sit back and not think. And meanwhile, as you're watching, say, a movie like The Searchers, one of the issues is one of the characters, John Wayne, keeps sneering at as a half-breed, and this is, this is like 1954, and, there's a not too subtle statement about racism, where if it was more explicit, they might have had trouble getting the film made. So likewise, in the romantic comedies, they're getting into some very interesting issues about women's identities, about sex roles. I mean, you look at something like Some Like It Hot, and the Freudians and the gender critics, they have a field day with this movie where men pretend to be women and everybody's donning disguises, and what does it mean to be masculine or feminine?
Yeah.
But you could also just sit back and watch this farce of these two musicians disguised as women to escape from the gangsters.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have a Marilyn Monroe story you'd like to share with us?
Marilyn Monroe was very, very difficult to work with. She was very insecure about her talent, which was not inconsiderable. And as a result, she could be a real pain. One of the most famous stories from Some Like It Hot is she has a scene near the end when they have to flee from the gangsters again, and the Tony Curtis was donned. Now, a male disguise to woo her has to basically say goodbye because they're running off. And she comes in, and her one line in the scene, in the hotel room where they're now disguised as women, is, "Where's the bourbon?" She's going to drink herself into a stupor. It took them 2 days and I don't know how many takes to get her to say that one line. She would say, "Where's the bonbon? Where's the bottle?" They would write the thing down and stick it in the drawer she was looking in. And finally, like this, in the middle of the second day, Billy Wilder says, "Don't worry, Marilyn, you'll get it eventually." He's trying to support her. And she looks at him and goes, "Get what?" She's just oblivious. Now, Wilder, by the end of the film, had it with her, and one of his famous cracks was when asked if he would work with her again, having made two movies with her, the other one being 7 Year Itch, he said, "I've spoken to my psychiatrist and my doctor and my lawyer, and they say I'm too old and too rich to go through that again." But he later, looking back, he said, "You know something? I have a maiden aunt in Vienna. She would show up on the set on time. She would know her lines backwards and forwards. Who would pay to see her in a movie?
Yeah. Yeah. Where is the romantic comedy today?
Today, one of the trends I talk about in the chapter, there's something about Mary, which I discuss the odd hybrid of the romantic comedy, what I call the frat boy comedy, where you've got, you know, all this, you know, earthy sexual humor, you know, basically very snickering, a lot of bodily function jokes. Judd Apatow is the king of this now with 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up. And yet these films are interesting hits because, yeah, the guys come out, the ones who say they would never go to a romantic comedy like it because of the earthy humor, and yet women aren't turned off because there's also the romantic comedy element to it. So it's a curious but apparently successful hybrid. The trend that I like, and I wish he was working more, is the British director Richard Curtis, who over the last decade or so did Four Weddings and a Funeral and Notting Hill, and then he wrote and directed the last film I discuss in the book, Love Actually, which I just think is a tremendously entertaining movie, intertwining nine stories, one or two dramatic ones, mostly comic, most of them, but not all of them, about traditional romance. But absolutely delightful film. That's, you know, if ever I'm in a dark mood, I could put that on. And by the end of the movie, I just feel great.
I'm going to tell my husband that. We have to watch this movie because we didn't see it because he didn't really feel at the time like going to a romantic comedy.
It's something that it has so many different stories going on. He's sure to find ways to connect to the film. Even, you know, he may not like the traditional, you know, romance with Colin Firth, but he will undoubtedly like the story of Bill Nighy as this aging rock star who's trying to have a Christmas hit by doing a cover of an old song. And that story is not really a romance. It's really about the affection between this veteran singer and his long-suffering manager, who is trying to push him back into the spotlight. And this put Bill Nighy on the map. This is a guy who is essentially a British character actor that had been working, but people really didn't know. He did this Love Actually, and he is hilarious in it. Because he plays a character who simply doesn't care what people think. And so he goes on a TV show, and he says, "Kids, listen to me. Don't buy drugs. Become a rock star. People give them to you." and then there are other stories in there that are absolutely adorable. It's an early appearance of Keira Knightley, who is just lovely in it. A kind of a sad story with Emma Thompson. And
this sounds wonderful.
Oh yeah, and Hugh Grant, who is sort of like Richard Curtis's on-screen alter ego, plays the new British Prime Minister who takes a fancy to the tea girl until he thinks that the visiting American president has made a pass at her. So if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend that one.
Yeah, okay. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign. Line one, good afternoon.
Yeah, Alden Alda, same time next year or somewhere, was that the film? Did that make the grade or not?
Yeah, well, it's a lovely romantic comedy. There are many, many great romantic comedies that are not in the book. I tell the story of the making of 15 films from 1932 to 2003. Same time next year is essentially a filmed version of the play. Mm-hmm. It's a two-character play about a couple having this adulterous affair, but very romantic, and they meet like one weekend a year, and you see them over time. It's a charming film. It's I think it's Ellen Burstyn with Alan Alda, and it's a charming film. But no, that was not a film that I tell the story of.
Your second edition.
Yeah, there you go. I'll have what she's having, Volume 2.
Yeah. Yo, everybody has suggestions. There were cases where I went with films that I'm not a particular fan of because I felt they were important, like Pillow Talk, which the first of the Rock Hudson Doris Day films that I think tells us a lot about the 1950s. It's not a film I particularly enjoy, although there are people who still enjoy doing it, enjoy watching it. And then there, a film like Philadelphia Story, which is a great film, and I very much enjoy it and recommend it to anybody who hasn't seen it. It's not my favorite Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn film. I actually prefer the lesser-known Holiday, which they did 3 years before with the same director, the same writer, adapting the same playwright. But it's lesser-known, and I think everybody knows Philadelphia Story, so I went with that.
Yeah. When it comes to Pillow Talk, what was the film made just a few years ago that was a rather like an homage?
Oh, yeah.
And it was so much fun to watch it because it was like, oh, this is Pillow Talk, kind of. And the clothes were so fun to watch. It was it was a piece of fluff, but it was so much fun.
Yeah, it was a, Down with Love.
Down with Love.
Yeah, it was a really like a send up of the old.
Yeah.
And one of the problems, of course, is that the young viewers had no idea what was being spoofed. And so when Tony Randall, who appeared in the three Rock Hudson Doris Day films, shows up for a small role in Down with Love, it's his final film appearance, you have to be of a certain age or very knowledgeable about old movies to get the joke.
Yeah. Well, it was a lot of fun, Down with Love. I really enjoyed it. Like I said, it was a little morsel, but it was lovely to look at. So, back to where the romantic comedy is today. What do you think of WALL-E?
I suppose WALL-E is a romantic comedy. I would categorize it more as a science fiction animation. But, yeah, there's certainly a romantic element that's a strong part of the storyline. I loved it. I think... With the exception of Cars, I think Pixar has this record of just like they just keep getting better and better and better. Ratatouille and Monsters Inc. And Finding Nemo, and this is just they take it up to the next level. WALL-E will probably get the Oscar for best animation, and deservedly so.
Yeah. Any other picks at this point we should see? Anything that you would like to say about the upcoming Academy Awards?
About the Academy Awards, well, I'll mention a few titles of the ones that I like. That doesn't necessarily mean they will get nominated, or the ones that I don't like won't. But I think Doubt with Meryl Streep is one of the best acted films of the year. Frost Nixon, Frank Langella as Richard Nixon, is amazing. Milk with Sean Penn is another strong performance. Mickey Rourke and Marissa Tomei in The Wrestler. So there's just some really, really good stuff out there. And as long as we're just throwing out movie titles, I don't know if it'll has a chance at Best Documentary, but my favorite film of last year, which is out on DVD now, is a documentary called Young at Heart. It's about a senior citizen singing group. They're all people in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, and what they sing are rock songs. They're doing the Ramones and Sonic Youth and the Clash and, songs that they don't even understand. And they struggle to master them and make them their own. And it's funny and heartwarming and just a wonderful film.
Now, I wonder if that's been shown at the nursing homes that you go out and...
I'm sure that since it's come out on video that it's played. I know it's played in a couple of places I speak at. It's something that I have found is enjoyed by people of all ages.
Yeah. I have seen the trailer for The Wrestler. It looks fabulous.
Yeah. The Wrestler, I'll just put up the caveat. It may not be for every taste.
Yeah.
The premise is Mickey Rourke is somebody who was a big wrestling star 20 years ago. And now we see him in his, 40s or 50s, hanging on because there's no pension plan. And, where he used to play Madison Square Garden and he was a big star, now he's playing in American Legion halls. It's a real interesting character study, and it's Mickey Rourke's comeback film. He's great in it.
Yeah. You didn't mention Slumdog Millionaire.
Yeah, deliberately.
Okay.
I'm in the minority on that.
All
I don't
right.
like it.
Okay. Let's talk before we wrap up here about It Happened One Night. This film won the top Oscars in 1934, and lots of folks thought this movie would be soon forgotten, and some people were shocked that It Happened One Night won those awards.
The story about the making of It Happened One Night is almost as good as the film itself. Basically, they were doing it as punishment. Clark Gable was a leading man, but not yet a star at MGM, and he had made three or four films back-to-back, and he had had an appendectomy, and he wanted some time off. And when Harry Cohn at Columbia Pictures, which was practically a Poverty Row studio, wanted to borrow a big MGM star, Louis Mayer said, no, you can't have Robert Montgomery. He thinks there's too many bus pictures, but I've got a star I want to spank. You can have Clark Gable. And he sends Gable over as punishment. And Gable knows he's being punished, but he's under contract. He's got to go. And he shows up for his first meeting with director Frank Capra drunk. And Capra says, "You want me to tell you what the movie's about?" And he goes, "No, just give me the script." And then he looks around Capra's office and he says, "You know, I always wondered what Siberia was like, but I didn't know it would smell like this."
Oh.
And later when he sobers up and reads the script and decides, hey, this looks like fun, he calls up Capra to apologize, and Capra says, "Don't worry about it," and he puts that surliness into the character that Gable plays in the movie.
Yeah. And Claudette Colbert?
She was a star, and she had also been overworked and was on vacation when Columbia decided, we've got to get this movie into production, and they tell Capra, go get Claudette Colbert, after all these actresses turned the part down because the actress is in one outfit for almost the entire movie instead of being glamorous. And Colbert was under contract to Paramount, but she had the option to make one outside film a year. And so she made outrageous financial demands, and Capra was told, meet them. And she ended up making more in overtime in the production of the film than Gable got paid for the whole picture.
Yeah. And at the close of it all, when the shooting ended, she thought that film was terrible.
Right. She thought it was terrible. Gable went back to MGM figuring, well, you know, I did my time. And then all of a sudden, it became this huge popular success. The modern example, not so much with the Oscars, but in terms of how the public responded, would be My Big Fat Greek Wedding. Something that was dismissed by the critics, the studios didn't think much of it, and the public went nuts. And people were seeing it three and four and five times. They were dragging friends and family, you got to see this movie. And it became a huge word-of-mouth success.
Mm. We've got one last caller hanging on here. Let's squeeze in this one last call in Kankakee County, line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. I'm calling to put in a word for my favorite Grant Hepburn film, and maybe my favorite film, period, and that's Bringing Up Baby.
Mm. Okay.
Bringing Up Baby is a great film. I've used it in class. It's a madcap comedy. I mentioned it in passing in the chapter on Philadelphia's story because Bringing Up Baby is where Hepburn started to learn how to play broad comedy. They actually brought an actor into the production to teach her, and he was so good that Hepburn said to Howard Hawks, the director, hire him, put him in the movie. I don't want to lose this guy. And he was hired, a guy named Walter Catlett, was like a vaudevillian, and was hired to play the town constable, so that he would be around to coach Hepburn. A very, very funny film. Now, oddly enough, and I mentioned this as well, Bringing Up Baby and Holiday, my favorite, were such big flops when they came out that Katharine Hepburn was dubbed box office poison. Her contracts were canceled, and she went back to New York, figuring her movie career, and she'd already won two Oscars, that her movie career was over. And she appeared on Broadway in a little play called The Philadelphia Story, and Howard Hughes bought her the movie rights, and she came back to Hollywood when they wanted to buy the movie rights from her, and she said, here's the deal, I'm starring in the movie. And that was her comeback.
Good for her. Well, there we've got to leave it. What fun. Daniel Kimmel, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Daniel Kimmel is the author most recently of I'll Have What She's Having, Behind the Scenes of the Great Romantic Comedies. The book is published by Ivan R. D.